This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. It's been over 70 years since the end of the Holocaust, but the stories of survivors from this dark time in history are just as powerful and compelling today. For 10 years, Viterbo University in La Crosse has brought in a survivor of the Holocaust to share their story with the community through Viterbo's Teaching the Holocaust workshop. Joining us today is Holocaust survivor Magda Herzberger, a psychologist and author from Romania. Magda, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
You know, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you're originally from Romania, correct?
Yes, originally. I was born in the city of Cluj, which is the capital of Transylvania.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your family and your childhood before the war?
Yes, Transylvania changed hands before the Second World War, or the First World War. It was a province in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but you know, after the war, it was annexed to Romania, and then 1940, it was Hitler forced Romania to give up part of it, and then in 1944, Hitler occupied it. So the good times for us, Jewish people, you know, was in my early childhood. I had a very happy childhood, and my grandparents, in addition to their alcohol factory, and they had a mill, a flour mill, and they had also an estate. And it was beautiful, you know, in the summer especially, because the winters were very, very tough there. We had the Transylvanian Alps and the Carpathian Mountains, you know. Transylvania is surrounded by mountains. It's a very mountainous territory and very cold climate. On a holiday, we would go out to the farm, and they had cows there, and they had the chicken and an orchard, and us children were playing, you know, had many cousins. I was the only girl, and my grandmother adored me, you know, and I was kind of spoiled. Life was good for us, but things changed, and the thing changed drastically. When I became a young teenager, 11 years old, because at that time it was, you know, in the 30s, and especially the middle and late 30s, the middle of started already when Hitler was getting power, that the Romanian government was strongly drawn to Nazism and fascism, and they adopted Hitler's anti-Jewish policies. So for the first time, I experienced what it means to be Jewish, because we were discriminated. And they introduced anti-Jewish laws. And the one that really was affecting me, that was the first law, the law of numerous clauses, whereby only a very small percentage of Jewish people were admitted in high school. And if you were Jewish, you had to have an almost perfect grade average in order to even think of it that you can get into high school. My first day in high school was shocking, because all the teachers were very anti-Semitic, including the principal. And the moment they came in the first time, "Jews, stand up." That was the first thing that they said. And I was very offended. Why the Jews have to stand up? We found out later that if the Romanian did not answer, the Jew was asked, see? So we were terrorized, because you could not afford the bad grade. So you had to be 100% prepared, just in case the Romanian is not going to not question. You knew that the Jewish students, we were only six Jewish students, you know. When we got out of the school, some students were good students. Others were anti-Semitic because of their parents. And they greeted us with very degrading limericks. They had a nickname for us, Jidan, not Jew, which is very degrading, you know. And then they were throwing stones, small stones after us. And I went home my first day of high school crying all the way home when I walked. And I asked my father, I said, why did they do this to us? We did not commit any crime. We don't deserve that. And my father said, well, I can't explain to you, but I give you a good advice. you make sacrifices for your studies. The sacrifice you have to make now is to tolerate the discrimination and keep your mouth shut, because if our parents would complain, I would be more discriminated. I would single out, you know. When the Germans came in, that was the apocalypse of all of us Jewish people. Then it was the real beginning, I would say, of the Holocaust. And everything took such little time, because they came and occupied our city, you know, the city of Cluj. And it was on March 27th, 1944. And then in April 1944, all of us of Jewish faith were forced to sew on our outer clothing the six-pointed yellow Star of David, which is the symbol of Judaism. But it had to be yellow because that symbolized the dirty Jew. And then in the middle, if somebody would know that we are Jewish, was a in big letters, Jew. From that time on, we were scared, because if you know, there were anti-Semitic elements, they felt free to beat you up, you know. And we went out only for absolutely necessary things on the streets. And then another month passed by. This was May 1944, when we were forcibly taken out of our homes. And we were taken out by a special Hungarian police called the gendarmes. They collaborated with the Nazis 100%, and they were just as evil and rude and cruel as the Nazis. So then we were pushed around. They brought into our house. We had to leave everything behind, the whole what was in the house. And then when we left the house, our homes were looted. Everybody could go in and pick up things that they want from the house. And then we were exiled in the so-called ghetto. Now, the ghetto was a territory located on the outskirts of the city at the site of an old abandoned brick factory. We lived there under terrible conditions. We slept on the ground, on a bare ground. We didn't have running water, and our nutrition was very poor. By the end of May 1944, we were taken out from the ghetto and deported to the German concentration camps in bolted railway cattle wagons. We were pushed into small compartments, 80 to 100 people. And we traveled in those trains for 3 days and three nights, with no food, no drinks, and no toilet facilities. In the corner of the wagon was put a pail for 800 to 100 people. That was our bathroom facility. And you know, we were men and women and children. it was a terrible ride. And after that period of time, we finally arrived to my first camp, Auschwitz-Birkenau.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Magda Herzberger, a survivor of the Holocaust from Romania. Magda's visiting La Crosse this week to speak at Viterbo University's annual Teaching the Holocaust workshop. And Magda, you were just talking about, you know, your arrival to the concentration camp in Auschwitz. And I know that Auschwitz is one of the most well-known camps from the Holocaust. You know, what was your experience like there?
I think that many people don't know what Auschwitz was really like. It's a different thing speaking about and describing, but being there. And I was there. When we arrived, we had to face a selection committee of the SS officers, headed by Dr. Joseph Mengele, who was one of the most notorious criminals, and I have seen him in the camp every single day, and the terrible deeds that he did. In my book, Survival, I give you testimony of my life daily life in the camps, in each of the camps. We were on a selection platform and waiting for the other prisoners to come out. My father and my uncle were at my side. We were ultimately separated. Then we were ordered by the SS officers to form two columns, men on one side, women and children on the other side. And at that point, I was separated from my father and uncle, and they both perished in the concentration camp of Dachau. And then the selections started, which were shocking and agonizing. Dr. Joseph Mengele was the chief selector. He looked at you and decided whether you go to the left or you go to the right. All the people who were not considered useful, like children up to age 14, old people, sick people, the pregnant woman, the invalids, the mentally disturbed, they were motioned by Dr. Joseph Mengele to the left. They were gassed and cremated in the killing facilities of Auschwitz. There were four killing facilities equipped with gas chambers and crematory ovens. So all these people who were not considered useful were gassed and cremated shortly after their arrival to Auschwitz-Birkenau. And many of my family members were in this category, all our little children in the family, pregnant women, old people, you know, my mother's aunts, uncles. I mean, it was a terrible thing what they did to us. And then those of us who were pointed to the right, I was young and I was a very strong girl because I was a competitive fencer, you know. I was selected for the gruesome task of dragging the corpses of the innocent victims, digging death pits where the bodies were thrown in, and put to fire, you know. Because at that time when I went there in 1944, the extermination was in its strongest time, you know. And all these transports came, and the Hungarian transports. So I don't know if people know that every day 27,000 Jewish people were gassed and cremated. They were also the political prisoners. They were nuns and priests, and all those people who did not agree with Hitler's anti-Jewish policies. But we were this crematory of instant killing facilities at the beginning, you know, were established mainly for the destruction of the Jewish people. Auschwitz was also surrounded by barbed wire fences charged with high-intensity electrical current. Once you arrived to Auschwitz, you were not a person anymore. You had no name. You had a tag. At that time, they did not even took the trouble to tattoo you. I was fortunate that I wasn't tattooed, and on our whole transport wasn't tattooed. There were 44 barracks, you know, very primitive barracks with holes on the roof and in the walls between the wood planks, you know. We slept on the floor, 500 people, you know, and it was like sardines. I mean, we were a starvation diet. What we got, it was terrible, just a little coffee, they called coffee. It was black water and in the morning, and then nothing during the work, you know, nothing the whole day in the afternoon, a 6.5-ounce piece of bread, always stale bread, preferably black bread. And then it was a patch of margarine on it. Then the soup. The soup was the most disgusting thing because it had a foul smell, and then there was nothing else in it but slices of rutabago vegetable floating on the surface mixed with sand because they never washed anything. So that was our food. Daily food. Now you can imagine what it is like to work. We didn't get any fluids during the work. as morning started, our torture, I would say, started. They woke us up at 3:30 in the morning. We have to stand so-called roll call to be counted, and the German officials came, and then we had the block leaders who had to report, you know, and whether it was raining or whatever the weather was, we had to stand in line there, aligned. Life in Auschwitz was a nightmare, and reality became a nightmare. So and then there were additional selections at the end of each week where the committee came in, you had to strip, and they looked at you, and they decided, are you going to live or are you going to die? So can you imagine what it was like, the fear at by the end of the week? Now they're coming, the committee, are you going to be taken to the gas chambers or are you going to be used as guinea pig in horrible medical experiments conducted in the laboratories of Dr. Joseph Mengele or for other horrible purposes? I was fortunate. It was a miracle that I survived 7 weeks in Auschwitz. And after this period, I was taken with 500 other young women to my second camp, the camp of Bremen, in the city of Bremen. That's the second largest port in Germany. At that time, it was the wartime there. It was like being out in the war. The city was bombed day and night by the Allies, and then we were taken there for slave labor in order to clear the ruins of the city, to remove the bodies of the aerial bombing victims laying in the streets and under the rubble. These were the people who didn't find shelter in time, and they were hit by the bombs. We had to carry heavy stones, pipes, and bricks from the bomb buildings. And so I felt compassion for all the people who were victimized by the war. And I didn't know if I could survive those huge bombardments. Twice our camp was hit while we were working. And it was lucky that we were not in, because we would have perished, all of us. And we were happy whenever we found some rags or under the ruined homes. And we would wrap them around our hands and feet in order to prevent our extremities from serious frostbites. Serious frostbites ended up with amputations of feet, of toes and fingers. And those people who were in that terrible predicament were sentenced to death because they were not useful anymore. The harsh winter, the hard labor, the lack of food took a toll on us. We lost a great deal of weight. For the first time, we were considered not useful. And we knew by that time what it means. It's like a death sentence. So we were taken from Bremen and we were forced to march 40 kilometers on foot, without food, without drinks, and whoever couldn't go on anymore was mercilessly shot by the SS guards.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Magda Herzberger, a survivor of the Holocaust from Romania. Magda's visiting La Crosse this week to speak at Viterbo University's annual Teaching the Holocaust workshop. And Magda, you just left off telling us about your arrival to the Bergen-Belsen camp.
We arrived in the middle of the night, exhausted. Half of us didn't make it. Half of us did not survive the death march. And it was dark because it was wartime. And I was at the end of a very long column. The women's barracks there were full. Nevertheless, the SS guards started to push in more and more people. The poor women were yelling, there's no more place, no more place. But they still pushed on and on. And at one point, there was no way you could push even one person in. And they said to us, those of you at the end of the column, just lie down for the night wherever you are standing. So we did. And in the morning, we were horrified to see the ground of Bergen-Belsen littered with thousands of corpses. And we found out that we were sleeping among them. The stench was terrible. The people in the barracks looked like walking skeletons. The barracks were infested with lice, rats, and all kinds of diseases. And people could not carry out their dead. So the dead was with the living in the barracks, and many of them had dysentery, and they could not reach the latrines. They were too weak, and they were lying helplessly on the wooden floor of the barracks in their urine and excrements. Why did they took us there? In order to clear the campground from the bodies, to dig the death pits where the bodies were thrown in and incinerated. And some of us, and those especially who came before us, were too weak to drag anymore the bodies. So they were ordered to strip them of clothing, and they were put up in a pile. We called it the Pyramid of Death, naked. By the end of third week in Bergen-Belsen, I was used up. And one day while dragging a corpse, I collapsed. And I collapsed by a trunk of an old tree. And I was by that time 19 years old. And I was lying helplessly, surrounded by corpses, waiting for death. I prayed to God to have an easy death. I prayed to God that I should be buried next by the roots of this birch tree, so that maybe I will be transformed in another form of life, and my spirit maybe is going to be taken to heaven. Honestly, I was in a state that I could not move anymore, I couldn't talk anymore, and then I heard big noises, commotion, screaming, and I was afraid to open my eyes. I thought maybe I'm on the other side, but what will I see, you know? But I couldn't help because the noise became bigger and bigger. And I opened my eyes. And what I saw, I thought either I am on the other side or this is a vision, this is a hallucination. I could see the gates of Bergen-Belsen opening, and I could see the British tanks coming in, the liberators. And I did know at that time that I will live, but miraculously I survived. And then later on in life, when I became a writer, I wrote my memorial poem, Requiem, for them. I have other memorial poems, but one of them is the Requiem. I am also a composer and a poet for many years. If you would allow me, I would like to recite to you my poem, Requiem. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Requiem. My eyes shed drops of tears into the pools of years for those I loved and lost. And like a hunting ghost, my spirit roams around, searching for their unknown burial ground. They were the victims of their fates, sentenced to death without a sin, for worshiping the only God they believed in. They died without protest, with no rebellion, together with the rest of 6 million innocent Jews in the Nazi camps of Germany. Oh, Lord, please help me to keep alive their memory. They died in vain. I witnessed their agony and pain. I heard their cries. Oh, Lord, our God, please open for them the gates of paradise. Let their souls rest in peace. Forgive mankind's atrocities.
And how has your writing and your music and your poetry, you know, how has that really helped you kind of work through these incredibly difficult experiences that you went through?
You know, when I came back from the Holocaust, I had to cope with a terrible grief that my family was annihilated. And also, I had to cope with the effects of the big frostbites that I had on my toes, and all my fingers were swollen and red, and I had a whole year treatment for them. And thank God, they healed. Then I also suffered for water retention due to effect of starvation. So it takes time to recover from the physical effects. But then the emotional effects, they are lasting a long time. The shadows of the Holocaust are still haunting me, because those are the horrific memories from the camps, which are buried in the depths of my soul. But from time to time, they surface and manifest themselves in different forms. You are going to find them in my poetry. You are going to find them in everything I write. You are going to find them in the stories in my book. And they also appear in my dreams in the form of very frightening nightmares. And those are the scars. They represent the scars of the Holocaust, which sometimes they take me to the desolate, arid, and forsaken desert of loneliness, where I am trapped and haunted by the dark shadows of melancholy. Now, this reflects in my poetry, you see. The Holocaust was the springboard of my writing. It stemmed from that great suffering, you know. And I wrote for 9 years poetry. I did not want to touch the Holocaust, because I felt that I don't want to evoke those memories. I suffered from nightmares for years. Even now, sometimes I'm screaming, you know, my husband is shaking me.
Magda Herzberger, Holocaust survivor from Romania, is here with us today to talk about her life and her writing, thanks to Viterbo University's annual Teaching the Holocaust workshop. Coming up, we'll talk with La Crosse County's new Health Department Director for National Public Health Week. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.
From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. This week is National Public Health Week, and La Crosse County's new Health Department Director, Jen Rombowski, joined us in the studio to talk about a number of public health issues that affect the Coulee region. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Rombowski about how the public health system works.
A lot of people think that public health exists only in the government sector. Actually, if you looked at the Wisconsin Public Health Association's website, which is one of the two major public health associations covering Wisconsin, it is a lot more than just governmental public health, but it exists in layers, as do many things. And so you have that federal layer with Centers for Disease Control, you have the state layer with the state health department, and you have a local layer with local health departments. And all of the partners that work with us from higher institutions of learning, such as University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, to city planners to look at how streets are developed, to folks in the hospital setting, in the clinic setting, and other healthcare areas. There are so many partners that you wouldn't always think of. So we work with those partners to make sure that we can move forward with things that help make the healthy choice the easier choice for the residents who we serve. Where we live, work, learn, and play.
La Crosse has two major medical centers, and they play a very important role. They're kind of the first responders, so to speak, in the public health arena, aren't they?
Yeah, in a way, you know, we work with them very closely. They see things that come in from a disease standpoint, from an illness and injury standpoint. But hopefully, one of the pushes public health makes is for people to have a primary care doctor. So someone who is generally charged with overseeing someone's health at an individual level. The difference with public health is that we look at populations. So we look at groups of people, communities of people, individuals included. So our focus is a bit broader than just the individual and the family in which they live. It's the community in which they live and the entire system that serves them.
When you're talking about public health, you are basically talking about things that people hear from their primary doctor once a year, aren't you? I mean, those are the basics, the core of public health, taking care of yourself first.
Right. I think the difference is that the primary doctor is looking at an individual. They're looking at one person in the family in which they live. And then we take that information and try to build on it. Yes, lots of the same messages, but it's different hearing that message in a short office visit with your physician once a year than going out in your community and seeing the trailhead start that you can walk on, and it continues to go in many directions to make it an interesting walk for you to go on, you're much more likely to do that on a more regular basis. So that's where public health's voice is to develop policy and set practices so things like that are easier for you in order to follow your doctor's advice.
So let's talk about some individual public health stories or messages. And I want to start with smoking because that's the one that's probably been out there. The message has been out there the longest in this country as far as public health. And it's been an issue ever since I've been around. How are we doing with smoking?
We are doing better than we had in the past with smoking. It's not perfect. As you think about health behaviors, which smoking is, it's a choice and it's an addiction. And anything that is an addiction is a long-term choice. And so once you've become addicted to a product like nicotine, it takes time and effort for you to resolve that addiction. And it will likely be something that you'll struggle with for many, many years. You know, same thing with obesity, with food addictions, with heroin and drug addictions. You know, that's really what we need to understand is that it starts as an addiction. And then we need to know that the gateway component of nicotine and tobacco products, thinking about our youth and making sure that it's not getting into the hands of our youth. The tobacco companies are very intelligent, very good at marketing. They know how to catch their consumers early with colorful products. And you've seen that in the industry over the years change from being cigarette based to now having products like little things that look similar to a Tic Tac, for example. And they have nicotine in them, or the e-cigarettes. And that's a controversial topic because some people believe they can use it to stop smoking, but it depends upon what products are actually in that e-cigarette. And there are always concerns that whenever you expose someone to nicotine, that it can be developing into a habit that will plague someone for a long time.
What is your opinion of the e-cigarette?
I've done a lot of research on the e-cigarette, and I can understand the perspective that people would like to use that as a product to quit smoking. I won't say that's not possible. However, from a public health standpoint, a broader picture, remember we look at populations. In my opinion, it is an easier way to introduce nicotine than not having an e-cigarette. So I can understand the other perspectives out there, but I think that it is generally not proven to be a safe product for use.
Is alcohol considered a public health concern?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. You know, it's something that is unfortunately second nature to many individuals. There's a bar around every corner. That environment makes it easier for people to make that choice. So again, we're talking about how easy is the healthy or the unhealthy choice is probably the main component of my message, and that's what public health tries to influence. When we have graduation parties and birthday parties that have alcohol part of them, it makes it easier for people to pick up that habit. I think when it gets concerning is when alcohol is used in a fashion that isn't safe or isn't healthy. So it's not in moderation at this point. And when you have things like binge drinking, where you know have five or more drinks in a setting that causes people to feel differently and their behavior to change, and they are more likely to take risks than they would be otherwise. So it is a drug. It impacts and influences how we act, how we think, what we do, and that makes it a concern when it gets to the point of how many people in the population are choosing that as a behavior. And we don't want to see where alcohol becomes a drug of choice instead of natural coping mechanisms. That would be where the concern comes in.
Let's move on to another drug. This one is illegal, and it's one we've been fighting the last 2, 3, 4 years, and seems to not be getting better, and that is heroin use in this area. It seems to be getting worse. Is it getting worse?
You know, I can't speak to whether or not it's getting worse. I'm fairly new here, but what I can say is that in the research that I looked at, we do seem to be a bit worse than other counties our size in Wisconsin. So that is concerning. When I look at drug overdose deaths, the number that we have, and the other item that I looked at was drug arrests. The number of drug arrests that we have in La Crosse County is quite a bit higher than other areas that are our same size in the state. So it's hard to know. You know, I do believe that it is a problem here. I can definitely say that it is a problem in La Crosse County. But one thing that I know is again, heroin and other illegal drugs are addictive. And I have heard multiple times that the first choice is the only time you're really able to make a choice. Once you're addicted, which with heroin happens very, very quickly, as soon as you try it, you are addicted to it. And then it really isn't a choice thereafter. So it's really about not trying it in the first place, which is, again, easier said than done if you're living in an environment where it's easily acceptable to you, someone introduces you to it, your environment makes it easier. We need to make sure that the environment is not making it easy to use heroin. And one of the factors in the rise in heroin is the fact that, again, policy comes into play, whether you like it or not. It's important for people to be engaged with what legislators are choosing for policy, because when we saw the change with prescription drugs, painkillers, with opioids, those became much more expensive and more difficult to get. You can get a similar result, unfortunately, from a drug like heroin, which is illegal. However, people then turn to that as a cheaper alternative. So these are the types of human behaviors that we need to be aware of in order to combat the problem. Sometimes the problem gets worse before it gets better, but awareness is a big piece of that, and we have a lot of effort and energy surrounding this initiative and this issue in our county, and I think that's a real positive. So I think people are realizing that they maybe can reach out for help. It's once you're addicted to the drug, it's timing. It's when you're ready, because until you're ready, the addiction cannot stop.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio, La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with La Crosse County Health Department Director Jen Rumbalski about public health issues. It's National Public Health Week. I hope I'm saying this right. Elizabeth Kingia.
That's correct.
I had never heard that term until a few months ago. And now all of a sudden, a lot of people are getting sick or dying from it in the southern and eastern parts of Wisconsin. What is Elizabethkingia, and should we be concerned about it?
Yeah, so Elizabethkingia, it's kind of a strange name. It's actually named after an individual who identified this particular gram-negative bacteria. So this is a type of bacteria that causes a bloodstream infection. And for the most part, is in southeastern Wisconsin. It's affecting individuals that are greater than 65 years of age for the most part. All individuals that have been affected by Elizabethkingia thus far, and I think the state is somewhere in the 50 to 60 cases numbers, the individuals have all have underlying health conditions, and so they had immune systems that were already compromised or decreased, and so they were susceptible to infection. But basically, it's an infection that can cause death and is very serious. So it isn't something that's currently affecting our area. However, we are keeping our eye on it. It is something that at the state level we are discussing on a weekly basis in the public health circles. So it's something we're watching very closely.
Jen, I also wanted to touch a little bit on the Zika virus because that has been a concern in the Americas, primarily Central and Southern America, but mm-hmm. I know there have been concerns with those who travel to those areas as well and bring it back to this country. We have not seen the Zika virus in this area, to my knowledge. What are the words of wisdom there from the public health director?
Yeah, so Zika virus, you know, we are very, very lucky in La Crosse County that we have already, what they have identified for Zika is that we should be treating for mosquitoes and we should be on the lookout for mosquito bites and preventing those as much as possible. So we every year talk about how to protect yourselves from mosquito bites. And it isn't just that they are a nuisance, it's that mosquitoes can carry diseases. Now, the type of mosquito that carries Zika virus does not exist in this area. However, people who travel to these countries that have Zika virus can come back. The mosquito then can bite in an individual who has the virus in their body and can pick it up that way and transfer it. So they can transfer the Zika virus, but it doesn't originate in the type of mosquitoes we have around here. So that's a little bit of background. Essentially, the Zika virus, you know, we have had an individual who came back from a country that is experiencing an epidemic, and we have been monitoring that individual. Oftentimes, it doesn't cause illness to the point that you would even seek a doctor's visit for, but it can be concerning in pregnant women, especially. So, there are specific guidelines around traveling to certain countries, and there are specific guidelines around pregnant women. So, if you are planning to become pregnant or are pregnant, it's something that you want to talk to your doctor about and be aware of. There is now evidence that it can be sexually transmitted from male to others. They haven't found that yet confirmed in females, but with sexually transmission of a disease, that's concerning because we have a lot of sexually transmitted infections as it is, and so we know that the activity allows for spread beyond, you know, what it is through a mosquito. So it's something that we want to be wary of. We want to be watching. But ultimately, the average individual out there needs to be protecting themselves from mosquito bites is the best way to prevent anyone from getting Zika virus.
Well, I know Mexico is one of the countries that's on the list where it's been an issue. Mm-hmm. And I know travel to Mexico is not unusual for somebody from this area.
We expect to have this be a major part of what we do in our health department in terms of our follow-up on communicable diseases. We expect to have reports from the state of people who are coming in who have been to countries and may have been exposed. So it's just, it's something that when you're traveling, it's something you want to be aware of, and especially with spring break coming up and the fact that it's sexually transmitted once you're back here, we just want to be aware of it and having people watch out for themselves and protect themselves from mosquito bites.
La Crosse County improved in the recent updated rankings of the healthiest counties in Wisconsin. I believe that's a nationwide snapshot of what's going on all over the country. And I don't want to get necessarily into specifics. We don't have to do that. But how do you view annual surveys like this?
Yeah, you have to understand that data is really important and really helpful, but data and assessments always have limitations. And this particular assessment, the county health rankings, is very helpful to us. It helps us understand where we're at. But one or two position moves isn't necessarily life-changing, and I would argue that it isn't. What we want to look at is what are we actually improving on and what are we not. Each year, we have to be careful comparing years past to the current year because they can make slight changes in the way they're using the data, which can make it non-comparable from year to year. But in general, it helps us understand where we are, if we're, quote-unquote, moving that needle to get to where we really want to be to make people's lives healthier.
As you look at this year's survey, what stands out to you?
What stands out to me is that we have improved in a number of areas. So I see that, one of the concerns that I want to mention is in the area of sexually transmitted infections. The chlamydia rate, although it's not just La Crosse County, it's across the state and likely across the nation as well, but the spread of communicable diseases through sexual contact is very concerning. The numbers continue to increase year to year, and we talk to people and investigate these cases and find that people sometimes don't know who their partners are. We just stress that you have, this is a very intimate connection you're having with an individual. It's a human need, and we would stress that whether it be abstinence or condom use every time, that you take precautions to protect yourself, know your partner's sexual history, and avoid getting sexually transmitted infections because they can be detrimental to your health long term.
You said you were in Chippewa County previous, and the big issue up there was suicide prevention. I think that's probably an issue all over. Mm-hmm. One person is
too many.
Mm-hmm. So do you bring something like that to La Crosse County, where I know people have been working on the issue?
I certainly would be willing to do that. I think I've been here just a couple of months now, and certainly heroin and the illicit drug use has been the major focus area, really receiving a lot of media attention. So again, it's about timing and connections, and I'm still working on making connections in the community. But when we talk about suicide, it took me a long time to understand that it isn't just the individual's life lost and the potential years of life lost that one individual presented. There's also quite vast and great family, community, and societal things that occur because of one suicide. And so, especially when that person is a young person, but really anyone, these are people that were loved, that were cherished by others. And I think, communities deal with those things in their own ways. And, it took me some research to understand that impact and how big it can be. And I talked to people at school districts, and even if it wasn't a young person, if a young person's life, if they were touched by a suicide of an uncle or an aunt or a cousin, no matter how far away it was, it had an impact on that individual, and therefore the friends that individual had in school, and that has a ripple effect. So suicide is a concern. I know that there's been 26 suicides in 2015 here in La Crosse County, 26, I believe, and that's a lot of people.
So what kind of impact do you want to have on the region in your time as health director?
It starts with me getting to know people and building positive relationships, because work can happen so much easier when you have partners and you have relationships built with people who all want to work in the same direction. I think that I would like to help partners break down silos so that we can work together better in La Crosse County. I also think that health does not happen in one neighborhood or another. It happens all over, and we need to balance out being focused on certain topics that are important, while also seeing that we're connected to a bigger network of a region and even a state and a nation. So we have to stay connected to those pieces as well. But I want to help this health department and this community continue to look at positive ways to make the healthy choice the easy choice.
Jen Rombalski is the new La Crosse County Health Department Director. She talked with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about public health issues as part of National Public Health Week. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.